You'll remember, beloved listener, and God knows we did a lot of programs about it, that 4 years ago Europe was struggling to cope with that biggest influx of refugees since the Second World War. As I said at the outset, over 1 million migrants arrived on Europe's shores in 2015 alone, crossing the Mediterranean in inflatables with thousands drowning before they touched land. And as I said a couple of weeks ago, the EU issued a statement declaring that the migration crisis is officially over. PR spin in the lead up to the European elections, or are we looking at something that's dinkum? British journalist Daniel Trilling, you might have read his stuff in the London Review of Books and the New Statesman, that's where I first came across him, is also the co-editor of New Humanist. And he spent over 5 years at Europe's border hotspots. The book that results is called Lights in the Distance, and it's based on a series of interviews with people who risk their lives fleeing war and poverty, only to end up trapped in the limbo of Europe's asylum system. And Daniel joins us from our London studio. Daniel, welcome.
Thanks. Hi, Philip.
Let me begin by asking you about that EU statement that the crisis is over. What's your response?
Well, put simply, it's not over for the people at the centre of it. So on the one hand, it's true that, as you say, the number of people arriving in Europe in search of asylum has fallen considerably from its peak in 2015 and 2016. And that has allowed the EU to symbolically move on. It's ended the kind of panic that was there among European governments during those unpredictable, chaotic points of the crisis. What actually exists is a situation that is much longer term. And the way I've tried to describe it is you've actually had two separate but linked crises going on in Europe. One was this increase in the number of people arriving that led to a political crisis and the various kind of reactions that resulted from that. But the other is something that I describe as a border crisis, which has been going on for several decades, which is all about a pattern that you see across the world where rich parts of the world have tried to wall themselves off from unwanted forms of migration as human mobility gets, more rapid because of globalization and other factors. And that what Europe has tried to do for many, many years is filter out asylum seekers and other migrants it doesn't want. And it has constructed this incredibly violent and dysfunctional system for doing so that increases the dangers that people face on their journeys to Europe. It increases this situation of limbo that you referred to when people arrive and they're trying to find a place they can get their documents, they can access their rights, they can build a new life and so on. And that has not ended.
Daniel, you point out that your book had two false starts. Now, the first false start is timely because, of course, of Christchurch. It was an attempt to write a book about the far right in Europe. But a trip to Athens convinced you that there was a more urgent story.
Yeah, that's right. My previous project had been writing about the far right in Britain, and I was interested in seeing what was happening elsewhere in Europe. That trip to Athens was in 2012, which was the year that this neo-Nazi party in Greece, Golden Dawn, had won its first seats in Parliament. And again, I was interested in finding out what were the reasons why there'd been this growth in support for a far right party. But I went around interviewing different residents of Athens on that trip, and the thing that shocked me the most was the situation of an Afghan family that I met there, particularly the mother, a woman called Hakima, who very kindly, let me into her life, explained all of the difficulties that people were facing. But frankly, she was very impatient with journalists coming and asking her the same questions. And when I was asking about, are you scared of being attacked by groups linked to this neo-Nazi party, she lost her patience and said, the police are just as bad. Our situation is completely hopeless because we're trapped. And the way she described it was being trapped, by the EU's asylum system and Greece's asylum system that was leaving them and many other people like them in a situation where they had no official documents. They weren't able to leave Greece. They weren't able to support themselves, and they were targeted not only by the violence of racist groups, but by the police and the state as well. So that made me think, well, actually, maybe there's something else going on here too. And that's what got me interested in investigating what was going on at the borders of Europe.
And the second false start?
Well, that was, I suppose that's what I initially wanted to do then, was map out this border system that was clearly having these effects in lots of different places, because at the time, sort of 2013 or so, you would read about similar situations, seemingly unconnected, cropping up in different parts of Europe. So there would be a crisis for Afghan refugees in Athens. Then you would read that Syrian refugees had suddenly arrived in Bulgaria and they were in these makeshift camps, that more people were arriving on the Italian island of Lampedusa and so on. And so I thought what I would do was kind of map out what was going on around the edges. But what I found was that when I started to meet people and get to know them, first of all, you know, their journeys would continue and they would be facing these same kind of challenges miles away from the geographical frontiers of the EU. So that made me think, well, what else is going on here? But also, the more that I got to know about people's lives, the way they tried to rationalize the decisions they were making as they were taking these journeys, the way that they were dealing with the often intense trauma that they had experienced either on their way to Europe or actually in Europe. And the way that they were trying to negotiate this whole system made me think, no, if you want to understand this, you've really got to see it from the point of view of the people experiencing it.
We're going to talk about someone you met in that notorious refugee camp in Calais. But first of all, there's been so much media attention on refugees drowning at sea. But you tell us that just as many migrants died crossing the Sahara.
Yeah, I mean, so that's a claim made by the UNHCR, and that's migrants coming from other parts of Africa trying to cross the Sahara, either to get to North Africa as a destination or to continue journeys to Europe. It's been a very, very dangerous route for years. You know, if you're in an unsafe vehicle that is crossing the Sahara Desert and it breaks down and you've got no means of asking for help, that's it, and you may well never be found, which is why it's much harder to collect reliable statistics. But this is partly what I mean when I talk about a border crisis, that the EU has had a direct impact on this situation, because one thing that it's done in the last few years in trying to stem the movement of people across the Sahara, in theory for their own safety, but actually I think the main motivation is just keeping people out of Europe, what it's done is broken up the safer, more reliable routes and pushed people to take more dangerous, more precarious forms of transport across the desert. So it's actually increased the risks that people face there.
Let's go back to Calais, where you visited one of the most notorious camps in northern France. Can you tell me about a young Sudanese refugee called Jamal?
Yeah, so Jamal is somebody I met on my first trip to Calais, which was in early 2014. You know, we chatted. He's a very, very likable young man, was very kind of curious about what I was doing there. We kept in touch after I left Calais. I lost touch with him for about 9 months and really had no idea what was happening to him, because I knew that he'd wanted to get across to the UK, and the means that people use to try and cross the English Channel are very dangerous and sometimes people die. So I thought, well, is he dead? I don't know what's happened to him. And then he suddenly cropped up on social media in another part of Europe. And so I went to visit him and found out his whole story about how he had ended up there. And Jamal had, you know, he'd left Sudan at the age of 18.
Just after his 18th birthday. And he
was taken
by people smugglers to Izmir.
Yeah. He was. He left Sudan on a false passport. He was taken by people smugglers to Izmir and then took a boat to Greece, which is the, you know, it's a very familiar route now. But he did this 10 years ago. So it was happening even before many people were aware of it. But what I was very struck by was that this, you know, Jamal, who Europe's legal systems, a lot of the European media would treat someone like him as a foreigner. I mean, he spent his entire adult life in Europe, yet without until a couple of years ago having any form of identification or documents or acknowledgement that he belonged there. He lived in Greece on the streets and in squats for 3 years, learning from other refugees how to, you know, how to survive by looking through bins, by picking stuff up off the street. He learned how to hide underneath lorries that were going through one of the Greek ports and eventually managed to get to Italy,
It's a miracle he survived even that. It's a very dangerous mode of transport.
Well, exactly. And I mean, he was, you know, for me, he was this window into this whole world that I had no idea about previously, because he was able to sit down and describe to me, well, this is how it works. These are the bits of the lorry where you look for to hide. You've got to hide between the wheel axle and the body of the lorry and the rest of it. So by the time I met him in Calais, he was already a kind of veteran at this. And then he spent another 5 months or so in Calais, trying but failing to get across to the UK, and got very, very discouraged. He became depressed, and then suddenly decided, well, why do I want to go to Britain anyway? I hear all these things about it. I've actually got no idea what it's like. And then went off and did some research and found another country somewhere else in Europe that he could get to and make a life for himself. And I mean, he's managed that, but you know, as much as I've known him and spoken to him, I still can't quite comprehend what it is to have lived that kind of life.
You talk about smugglers running the routes like a travel service, and there's an a la carte that ranges from a classic package, a journey in the back of a lorry for up to £2,000, to a VIP service, which is a trip in a car for up to £4,000.
Yeah, well, I mean, smuggling encompasses a whole range of things. I mean, it's, you know, often anti-migration policies are framed as being about combating the evil people smugglers or people traffickers who are fundamentally harming migrants on the move. And that sometimes is the case. It's particularly true with people coming through Libya. But really, smuggling is something that springs up to meet a need. And groups of smugglers tend to tailor what they offer to whether migrants have money or don't have money. So Jamal, who I mentioned, you know, he left Greece with €2 in his pocket, but was able to get all of the way to Calais, you know, forming alliances with different groups of people who were helping each other out, for example. But somebody else I met who had passed through Calais is an Iraqi woman called Zainab, who fled ISIS in 2014 with her 3 young children. And she was quite well off. She was middle class, and she had several thousand dollars with her when she left. And so she was able to pay a kind of established network of people smugglers that stretched from Iraq right into the UK for passage on lorries. But even then, I mean, these things are offered like they're a travel service, but it is still incredibly precarious. So Zainab,
well, in her case, she gets a ride with the kids, but they almost suffocate in the back of a refrigerated lorry.
Well, exactly, because even if you are relatively at an advantage in that kind of situation, as Zainab was, having money and the right contacts, things can change overnight. So what happened to her was that she made it with her kids all the way to Calais in a relatively short space of time. I think the whole journey took about 2 weeks from leaving her home in Iraq to reaching Calais in France. But then her reliable contact disappeared. She had to turn to another group of smugglers who basically stole the rest of her money. And then she was reliant on people who did not have her best interests at heart. And they ended up putting her in a lorry where the air flow was turned off, and the people inside very nearly all died. It was only because they managed to, someone had a phone and was able to call the police, that they were able to get out.
Now, the French riot police destroy the massive refugee camp at Calais, known as the Jungle, in 2016, but that hasn't stopped new waves of migrants arriving there.
No, and I mean, that's the situation that was there before 2015. I mean, I tend to think of that jungle camp in Calais as very symbolic of what's happened in Europe as a whole. You know, there was a situation for 10 years previously that anybody who paid attention could see was going on, but it suited both sides of it to keep it under wraps. You know, the French authorities tended to force the migrants out of Calais town centre, force them into hiding, but essentially let it continue. It became, in 2015, too big for everyone to ignore. You had this huge response of solidarity from European citizens who went to Calais, as they did to other bits of Europe, to try and help, to try and build sustainable networks so that people could survive. Eventually, you know, the authorities had to respond and demolish the whole thing. thing and have gone back to pushing it under the carpet, but the severe hardships that people face still remain. The unwillingness of French and other European authorities to come up with a solution that protects people's rights in a meaningful way continues, basically.
Daniel, I understand that Brexit is also having an impact.
Well, yes, I mean...
In that people smugglers are telling migrants they've got to enter the UK before the borders shut.
Well, I mean, there's that. There's also nobody really knows what's going to happen to the kind of cross-border arrangements France and Britain have after Brexit, whenever that happens. Obviously, that is all very up in the air at the moment. Yeah, I think, you know, at the end of last year, there seemed to be a... I mean, it was, you know, it was really overblown by the British media, and the British Home Secretary did a lot of grandstanding on it around Christmas, but there was a small rise in the number of people crossing to the UK, supposedly because smugglers had told them, you need to go now because after Brexit, you won't be able to do this anymore. But I mean, there are often those kind of unpredictable changes in the way that people move.
I hadn't realised that in December 2018, the UK began returning migrants who'd crossed the Channel in inflatable boats back to France.
Yes, I mean, in theory, they would have been able to make those kind of returns in other circumstances, so it wasn't an entirely new thing. I mean, the whole... This is one of the most dysfunctional aspects of the way things work in Europe, which is that, you know, for the time being as well, Britain is part of this. You have a European Union that is supposed to have common agreements on things like, you know, who claims asylum where, which country's responsibility it is to deal with their asylum claim, accommodate them and so on. But the way the system functions is everybody trying to pass the buck to somebody else, very often pushing the problems onto the poorer countries at the edges of the EU. And what happens in the middle of that is that very vulnerable people's rights get completely trodden over. So there's been a huge issue with Calais, particularly in the UK, of unaccompanied children who have got stuck in the Calais camps. They actually may well have relatives in the UK, and technically under these EU rules have the right to be brought over to the UK. But Britain has done everything possible to avoid bringing those kind of people over.
Daniel, in the time we have left, can you tell me about the book title, Lights in the Distance?
Yeah, so Lights in the Distance comes from somebody that I knew, I got to know over a period of several years, a young man originally from Mali called Caesar. I met him in Sicily shortly after he'd arrived in Europe. He'd travelled by, you know, one of these inflatable boats across the Mediterranean from Libya. And he told me this whole story of his journey, which had taken him about 18 months. He'd fled the civil war in Mali, but then had been passed from people smuggler to people smuggler in both Algeria and Libya. He'd suffered the full horrors of that journey. He'd essentially been kept as a slave and tortured at various points. But something he said really struck me and stayed with me, which was, you know, just one day kind of out of the blue, we were talking about something completely different and he went quiet and he said, you know, I was lost in the Sahara Desert for 3 days. You have to travel through the desert at night, and, you know, the desert is very empty. So what you do is you look for the lights in the distance on the horizon, and you head for those. You don't know what they are. You don't know if it's going to be safety or more danger, but you have to just keep hope and hope that it's going to be something better. And for me, you know, that phrase, lights in the distance, stuck in my head ever after that, and it really summed up the experiences that all the people I was speaking to.
I wish we had a lot more time, because we could also tell the story of your grandmother who fled Kiev in 1920, but people will have to buy the book to learn about grandmother. It's a terrific piece of work, and Daniel, I congratulate you on it. Lights in the Distance, Exile and Refuge at the Borders of Europe by Daniel Trilling. And as I said, Daniel is the editor of New Humanist, and the book is published by Picador.